Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 44. On this episode, we are talking about The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 1, based on the book series. We actually already have a Catching Fire episode, so we are catching up to the next installment in this series. Joining me to talk about it this time is Matt Anderson from the Sci-Fi Christian. He's been on before. I got a lot of positive feedback, and I really enjoy talking to him. And our new almost co-host at this point, Josh Crabb, here to talk about a book series that they've both read and enjoyed to some degree and didn't enjoy to other degrees. But this film in particular was probably the lowest critically rated film in the series to date, but that didn't stop it from making lots of cash, and for weeks it has been at the top of the box office. But this one finds Katniss in District 13, the supposed non-existent district, and her adventures there, or her trauma there, gives us plenty of things to discuss, such as post-traumatic stress syndrome, or in this case, post-traumatic game syndrome, a couple welcome changes from the books, the media's role in our culture, labeling people, and we have time to answer your questions about that hauntingly popular song. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Here it is, episode 44, Mockingjay and the Power of Propaganda. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. This is the biggest question. Do you guys actually love Krispy Kreme?
I'm going to say yes. Okay. But there's none around. In fact, the reason I'd always make a point to go there is because in Minnesota, we don't have any. So the closest one to me is the one that Josh was just talking about in Brookfield.
Oh, that's crazy. We had Krispy Kremes when I was growing up. I remember like some guy in the class below me when I was in high school, like won the contest for being the first one to camp out there the longest when it opened in Brookfield. And he got it for like free Krispy Kreme for a year. Ours was the exact opposite. We had like no Dunkin' Donuts around, and oh, so yeah. It was a huge deal when Dunkin' Donuts started franchising out in Wisconsin.
We still don't have that. We have no donut places around here.
What is the deal?
I mean, the people sell donuts, but like grocery stores and things like that.
Well, here's the thing. So Krispy Kreme is basically from where I'm at. Okay.
Really.
And I love Krispy Kreme donuts. When I think of a donut, I think of a Krispy Kreme donut. But you know, I basically. The big fluffy thing full of frosting that I put in my mouth, and when I bite into it, I don't even have to chew it. It just melts in my mouth, you know? And so they started putting Dunkin' Donuts around here, and we have a place, especially in Greensboro, called Donut World that's now kind of franchising, and they mostly make cake donuts. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, they're not Krispy Kreme, you know? I want these light, fluffy donuts, and everyone's starting to love it. And I think it's a byproduct of people being used to their surroundings and taking Krispy Kreme for granted. I think they've grown up with Krispy Kreme, and now Dunkin's moving in, and it's the latest thing. It's the pretty girl that just moved next door, but you know, you don't know that she's really cheating on you with somebody down the street, and she's gonna move away, and she's gonna break your heart. But you know what? Krispy Kreme's gonna be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you start eating Krispy Kreme, it's going to stay in your heart forever, and it's probably going to kill you.
So. Exactly. Preach it.
This is a great movie.
You know what this movie needed? More Krispy Kreme.
More Krispy Kreme.
You know, oh. I'm sort of dealing with that right now with Chick-fil-A. So Minnesota never had Chick-fil-A until last October. So whenever I travel for work, I go out of my way to pick hotels near Chick-fil-A's. I loved it.
Priorities.
Yeah, I loved it so much.
Well, it's the same thing in Wisconsin. The first one just opened in the Milwaukee area, and it was like, I think there was like practically riots to get into Chick-fil-A when it first opened.
Wait, is that the okay? So I have been to one in Wisconsin, in Racine. Is that the one you're thinking of, or is it a different?
No, it's the one. It's in actually in the Milwaukee area, like I guess it's in like the metro Milwaukee area, not all the way out by Racine. But yeah, there had been one in Racine for a long time, for a couple of years. But when one actually, I don't remember if it's in Milwaukee or Wauwatosa or something like that. But I mean, when it opened, it was like near riots to get there. I have a lot of family that lives there, and they one of them took a picture, and it was just like there were cars everywhere, there were people lined up outside. It was insane. It was just complete insanity.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to like burst this bubble for you.
Yeah.
But we have, I want to say 4 Chick-fil-A's in Greensboro, maybe 5. Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Surprise me.
And they basically are always like that, and we have them everywhere.
Wow.
Like I can't like. There's a Chick-fil-A that I mean, if I was more impulsive, I could walk to, and you almost have to walk, like you have to park in a neighboring parking lot most of the time.
Wow.
To go to this Chick-fil-A at any time of day. And you know, this Chick-fil-A has been there for, you know, long periods of time. It's not like it's brand new or anything. And when you're talking about your friend waiting for like Krispy Kreme or whatever, like they have those every time a Chick-fil-A opens as well. And you get like Chick-fil-A for a year.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh man. I mean, I love Krispy Kreme, but I would much rather have Chick-fil-A for an entire year for free.
Man, I love Chick-fil-A. It's my
gosh. Favorite. I don't want to love it as much as I do, but doggone it. They make a tasty chicken sandwich.
It sounds like we're here in the cold tundra of the Midwest, and Fizz is like basking in the glory of warmer weather and Chick-fil-A and Krispy Kremes.
And Krispy Kreme. Wow. No, you have to understand, I'm in this... Well, I mean, I am in the greater South, you know, I'm not like South, but
no. Yeah.
Here in North Carolina, since it is the South, we bask in comfort foods. So most of the foods that you love and enjoy probably come from the South.
Fizz, what do Josh and I have up here that you don't have that you wish you had?
More snow.
No.
No,
I love
quiet.
Snow cream.
Quiet.
Is there any food franchises that you don't have that you wish you had?
I mean, so, well, tell me something that's come from there, because that's the thing. I don't think so.
Nothing Culver's. Comes from there. It just gets here eventually. Oh, Culver's? Yeah, do you have Culver's?
Culver's? I don't know what that is.
Oh, now you're missing out.
Yes.
If you want cheese curds at a fast food restaurant.
If you want 7 different ways to have a heart attack, go to Culver's.
Culver Franchising System is a privately owned and operated fast casual restaurant chain.
It's very delicious. I've actually been to the
original
the city where it was originally founded. It's a pretty rad place. They actually have the people who owned it originally opened another restaurant that's called the Blue Spoon Restaurant. I can't remember where it is. I don't remember exactly what city it is, but I know I've been there. And it was really interesting because, I mean, the Blue Spoon, you think it's like, oh, it's going to be like some sort of shrine to Culver's, and it had absolutely nothing to do with Culver's whatsoever except for the name.
Hmm. Yeah, well, never heard of that one.
I think my favorite thing is that this is now like a foodie podcast.
Man,
not even joking about it. Like, we're all serious about this stuff. We're like, have you been to whatever?
That's one of my secret interests. I like sci-fi and fast food and restaurants.
I think that's. I'm gonna say I think that's most everybody. I don't think most people just admit to it.
Mm.
Like I don't think most people can go to a Chick-fil-A and not be like really passionate about how much they love Chick-fil-A.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
Unless they're taking some kind of like maybe possibly misplaced moral stance. You know, they're going to be like, I don't like this, while they're like turning around and eating a chicken sandwich. Like, you know, this is terrible. Ah, I'm eating it because I'm sad. I don't know.
Wait, so Fizz, you and I met because we both do podcasts. How do you and Josh know each other?
Because he's
here in my territory. I don't know. Not really. I'm in Minnesota. He's in Wisconsin. You're in North Carolina. What's the deal?
Yeah. So one of the reasons I started this podcast was because I listened to the I wouldn't necessarily call them podcasts at the time.
Yeah.
They were video reviews and or written reviews of James Harleman out in Seattle. And I just started this because he inspired me to do this show. Whether he, you know, I don't know if he'd take credit for it, but he's been on the show a couple times. And so after I started the show, I went out to Seattle just because I happened to be going out there. And I phoned him up. I said, hey, you know, will you let me interview? And he was like, okay, whatever. So we kind of built a relationship. Like I said, I had him on the show. And I think Josh was also kind of like a disciple of James Harleman and found my show because James has been on it a couple times. Josh, is that right?
Yep.
And so after that, Josh kind of was inspired as well, because it's really great when you start looking at film for more than just turning your brain off. Mm. And Josh launched his own website and started doing some pretty cool stuff. And I was like, hey, man, I saw this thing you're doing, and it seems really similar to what I'm doing. And I don't want to, you know, poo-poo that idea, because the more people who are really looking at film critically, the better. But would you maybe want to come do it with me instead of starting from scratch? I've kind of got an audience already. And Josh was like, yeah, I guess. So it's been great, because I have a number of guests. I mean, this show has been going on for a year and a half now, and I've had tons and tons of guests. I've got lots of what I would consider regulars for Real World, but most people have an interest in looking at film and theology. They aren't like super passionate about it. And Josh was someone else who was super passionate about it. So now us getting to work together has been kind of like exceptionally mutually beneficial, and mm-hmm. it keeps me on my toes, and I'm hoping I'm pushing him as well. So it's been great. And like I said, now I know someone from Wisconsin. I just love, like I said, this is what I was talking about earlier. I love knowing people, even though I've never met you guys. Like, we've had these great conversations, and that's to me is the beauty of the internet. When the internet is being used at its best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
I was gonna say, Josh could add anything to that he wanted. I was trying to give a.
Yeah, I don't really have much to add. I mean, you've pretty much got it about right. I mean, we're both just really
right.
We're just both really about right. There's some minor details that you're just, you know, skimming over. I have no idea what you're talking about, but I mean, but pretty much, I think that we both just probably had a mutual passion for it. And the crazy thing is basically we were probably about to start a podcast at the same time, and then I was moving here, and basically was like, I'm gonna have to delay it for like 6 months to a year while we get settled in and I find a new job and everything like that. And it's just gonna be too much work. And then I was like, I wonder if anyone else is doing this. And so I started listening to Fizz like in April of this year.
Oh,
I found the show and then I was like, this is cool. And so then I decided to get around to it. And yeah, essentially that's what happened. Like shortly after I launched the site, you were just like, let's work together. And it was like, that makes a lot more sense than doing it separately.
Yeah.
And it turns out we don't have both have giant egos. So we're not both like, we have to do our own thing.
I mean, I had mine pretty well, so.
Yeah.
I think what I'm hearing is Fizz's part of the story was part one, much like Mockingjay.
Mm.
But yours was part two. Wow, that's like a great segue into Fizz. Take it from here.
So it was almost such a good segue, but I think I have something better.
Oh my goodness!
Because it's my podcast. Well, it's not really my podcast.
Well, it kind of is your podcast.
So what it reminds me of, since you said that, and we can still let your segue hang. It reminds me of Ender's Game.
Oh,
and listening to my story is like reading Ender's Game. And listening to Josh's story is like reading Ender's Shadow.
Oh, yep.
Because it's the same story, just from a different perspective.
Wow. That's awesome.
So I really think that's basically our story. Our story is the story of Ender, you know, trying to, a young genius trying to save the universe. Mm-hmm. So I think that pretty much fits.
And Harrison Ford trying to desperately rescue his career.
Oh, man, speaking of Harrison Ford, so we're going to talk about The Hunger Games Mockingjay, and that was my transition.
Oh, okay.
So,
Wait, what?
So speaking of Harrison Ford, Star Wars, and instead of Star Wars, we're going to talk about The Hunger Games.
There might be some similarities between the original trilogy and these four movies in the Hunger Games series.
Oh, man, I hope we get to that.
Well, maybe we will.
Maybe we will if we ever stop stalling. So this is part one of the two-part penultimate, you know, finale for the Hunger Games series. The Hunger Games series, which I have still not read, for those of you who actually listened to the Catching Fire episode last year. But I believe that, Matt, you've read it?
I have. I've read everything.
Okay. And Josh, you've read it?
I have.
Look at that. See? So I make sure I have highly educated and exceptionally talented people on here to cover up for my misgivings. No, my shortcomings. There you go.
I think it's actually better that you haven't read it, but I think it's especially going to be useful when you review part two, just in the sense that we can ask you questions about, did you get this, even though you were only viewing, rather than, because I feel like Hunger Games has been notorious for, like, as a person that read the books, I'm not sure if people would pick up on these little things that were happening. But yeah, so I think your final installment of the series will be a good review.
Yeah, I'm really interested because I didn't really, this is skipping ahead, but I didn't really care for this movie, especially as much as I did like the last one. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that most of the people who actually took the time to read the books really liked this, because lots of their comments said that it improved on what they read in the books and stuff like that. So I'm really interested to see kind of where those two worlds collide. Like people saying, oh, well, they changed this and it was for the better, or they changed this. Or I'm just like, I never read the thing where there's lots of inner dialogue, so I don't understand what they're trying to convey lots of times. But if you haven't seen the previous two Hunger Game movies and you're listening to this, well, thanks for listening to the show, but you might want to go listen to those because we're going to spoil everything up to this point. So I just want everyone to know that. Because, like I said, this is the third movie in the quadrilogy. Is that a word? Can we say that?
Yeah, you can do that.
Okay. Oh, that's right. It's my podcast. I do whatever I want. So this one picks up right after Catching Fire, and the synopsis generally reads, when Katniss destroys the games, she goes to District 13 after District 12 is destroyed. She meets President Coyne, who convinces her to be the symbol of rebellion while trying to save PETA from the Capitol, which is a pretty broad idea of what actually happens in this movie. It's again directed by Francis Lawrence, the guy who I think kind of brought the Hunger Games series a step up with Catching Fire. Mm-hmm. And it stars Jennifer Lawrence, Josh Hutcherson, Liam Hemsworth, Woody Harrelson, Donald Sutherland, Philip Seymour Hoffman in one of his last films, Julianne Moore, Elizabeth Banks, and Stanley Tucci, among many, many others. I feel like this is almost like the Batman films, like the original Batman films, where, like, if you're anybody in Hollywood, you find a way to get a small part in the Hunger Games franchise.
Yeah.
Because there for a while, you know, the Michael Keaton Batman, like anyone, the Jerry Bruckheimer, like Schwarzenegger had to get in, all these people, anyone who was anyone had to be in a Batman movie, or you weren't really part of the creme de la creme of Hollywood, right?
Totally agree. Yeah, this is like the next big thing.
Or maybe besides the Marvel Universe, everyone's trying to get in there too. You got to be careful. But so we'll start this like we start most every other podcast. And just in general, what were your general thoughts? Did you enjoy it? What kind of stuck out to you? And you're both on Skype, so I would normally...
I'll toss it to Josh. Josh, go ahead.
Oh man, Josh gets to go first?
What? Me?
He's kind of a regular, so
yeah,
technically you're the more
kind of a regular.
I'm
so
the more Skype-ish person tonight. All right, I'll pick up on something.
You're 100% Skype-ier than Josh.
All right, Fitz, you were just mentioning something that's probably my strongest thought after leaving this movie, which was it has to do with Katniss in the book. From the book's perspective, it's all in Katniss's head. So the best thing about this movie is that we're able to get out of her head. So, yeah, I can see what you're saying about book readers enjoying the movie more than the book, because like most people, I thought the third book was the worst in the series. Mm-hmm. But I did not hate this movie. I actually liked quite a bit. I probably would give it a 3 out of 5 stars, maybe 3.5, depending on how I'm feeling. But yeah, I think Catching Fire was better, but this I was actually pleasantly surprised. I didn't know what to expect based on not really enjoying the book that much. But yeah, getting out of Katniss's head has been huge for all three of these movies so far. And I think this one has benefited from it the most.
Cool. Josh, how did you feel about the movie?
Yeah, I almost felt the same as Matt. the third book was my least favorite. I didn't like it necessarily as much, and Catching Fire was my favorite book, and I think it's probably going to end up being the favorite of the movies of mine. When I left, I didn't like it, but I think after having a little bit of time to think about it, I think I still like it. But I think I gave it on Letterboxd, I gave it 3 stars out of 5. I kind of felt the same way that a lot of the movie or a lot of the book was supposed to be in Katniss's head. You know, a lot of the interaction between her and Gale and her and Coyne and her and Plutarch and all these other people, it was mostly all from, you know, a lot of it was in her head, and a lot of this stuff contextually is in her head. And I feel like some of that got lost in the movie, but it was kind of nice to see some of that outside. But I mean, I thought Jennifer Lawrence essentially made the movie what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't for her, I think kind of my short synopsis of it on Letterboxd was basically that if it wasn't for Jennifer Lawrence, this movie would have been pretty terrible. And Katniss's character would have just felt like a whiny, like staring off into the distance girl. Kind of like with the your real quick reaction video with your friend Marshall. I don't necessarily fully agree with what he said, but it was absolutely hysterical what he had to say about the movie.
Yeah,
so
it was great because we did that in two different takes. The first one, like these people randomly just like walked behind us, like they saw us doing it, and they like just were like, eh, whatever. And so they walked behind us, so we had to stop, and we had to do a retake. And the first take, my buddy Marshall was kind of like, oh, I didn't like it that much, and then didn't say anything.
Oh,
like he
no.
just, and so, like, in between takes, I was like, hey, man, let me just tell us your first reactions, you know, just whatever you want to say. And so when he started talking and we kind of laughed a little, he just never stopped. I think he even embellished it more than he was thinking.
It was totally awesome. If I could share this quickly, one of my friends who really, really enjoys the Hunger Game books, and he's a good friend of mine that we typically talk about movies more than once a week, he called me. I don't even know. It was really late. But he was on a business trip and went and saw Mockingjay in his free time after work when he was on his business trip. And he called me, and it was just like the most epic rant about how much he hated the movie. And it was amazing. And it gave me horrible expectations, because I think between you and my friend Dick and my mom, who hated it too, I was really going in with really low expectations because of that. And it was like, well, I really like Catching Fire, and it's my favorite book, and Mockingjay is my least favorite book, and all these people have said they didn't like it. And so I went in expecting it to just be, you know, I mean, I don't want to say god awful, and it wasn't that bad.
Well, Matt, like, is this series only different because Jennifer Lawrence is in it? Like, or is there something more to the Hunger Games, or is Jennifer Lawrence just carrying it because she's generally pretty amazing?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that, because the primary thing everybody loves about the Hunger Games series is Jennifer Lawrence and her act. Mm-hmm. She really is a great actress. I mean, there are interesting things happening, but it just feels like if you think about the other main characters, they are just kind of dull. So I don't know. It might be that the characters weren't written well for the screen. I mean, even in the book, there some of the characters are underdeveloped, but I feel like so much was put into the Katniss character that a lot of the other characters were hurt by it. I think Hunger Games is an interesting concept, but it may be that it wouldn't be as successful without her leading the charge.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I definitely mentioned this when we talked on the Catching Fire episode, that when you want to have a franchise, you need to make sure you have someone can carry it. And I can't remember exactly when she was cast for the Hunger Games movies, but I know she'd already put out like Winter's Bone. And to me, if you've seen Winter's Bone, you've probably seen Jennifer Lawrence at her best. And that's taking into account like Silver Linings Playbook, and American Hustle, like things that she's won an Academy Award for, you know, I think it showed that she had the chops to play a tormented, someone who has PTSD, but still having to find ways to survive. Mm-hmm. Like,
I was just going to say real quick, you mentioned this in your Catching Fire review, but her acting really evokes emotion in the viewer. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not an emotional person, but yeah, in Catching Fire, in parts of this movie, you start to tear up a little bit. You're like, what's happening to me? Well, how is she doing this?
Well, I would say that's one of my biggest differences. And I want to make sure that I'm pointing out two things. One, if you've read Josh's review at the Real World Theology site, I think he makes a good point about this. And I've said this on the Movie Bite podcast when I had a chance to be on there, that it's really hard for me to say I love this movie or I hated this movie. And generally, I don't like to talk about movies being good or bad because there's so much there, whether it's a good movie or a bad movie, like cinematically. But I feel like we can reserve judgment on how much we really enjoyed this movie until we see the part two, because it's one whole story. And I feel like we just got the primer. We got like the introduction, or I think, like, as Josh said, like act one.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to say that I didn't like this movie, but there were parts that I didn't enjoy. Now, at the same time, I thought that in Catching Fire, everybody did an amazing job. I think when I talked about what I love most about that movie, it was like Elizabeth Banks, like Effie's character, and how she was given just enough to work with to really evoke an emotional response, just like you're saying, Matt. And I feel like every character in Catching Fire had those moments. Like, PETA had those moments. Caesar, you know, Stanley Tucci's character, Caesar Flickerman, mm-hmm. like, evoked emotional responses from you. Mm-hmm. Like, even Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, Plutarch, was in his subtle ways, you're like, man, he's got something going on. And I felt like in this one, they were so focused on showing us the pain or the torment or that PTSD that Jennifer or the Katniss is going through, that everyone else didn't really have a lot to work with. I mean, because it's not just that Jennifer Lawrence is the only good actor in this movie. Like, I'm a big Woody Harrelson fan. I think Donald Sutherland's great. I mean, Philip Seymour Hoffman is probably going to be one of the best character actors that we've ever seen on screen. Mm-hmm. You know, like, these aren't nobodies, you know?
Yeah, it is crazy. Let's just talk about let's look at PETA for a second. He's supposed mm-hmm. to be the male lead in this movie. Or, I mean, in all the movies, really. And he's, I think you might have even said this before, he just kind of comes off as wimpy. And my wife was a big fan of the books. She loved PETA as a character. But in the movies, he just, I don't know, he's just kind of nothingness. like he's just not just in stature, but in but in the presence that he has. He doesn't have a presence. I think that's you need both sides to really push a story fully forward, and I think she's carrying the full load here.
So I'll say something that's a foil to what I basically just tried to argue. In the first two movies, I think that PETA's character didn't do enough, and he did come off as wimpy. You know, when they're showing him prepping for the games and stuff, and he's throwing big rocks and whatnot, I'm like, no, like seriously, like Josh Hutcherson, you're trying to convince me that he's like somehow like mysteriously strong. Where is he hiding that at? And so most characters, I think, in Mockingjay Part One didn't have a lot to work with, including Josh Hutcherson. But I thought that every time Josh Hutcherson was on camera with what little he was given to do, he showed the progression of PETA through thinking he was doing the right thing, trying to care about Katniss, and then slowly understanding that he was being used as a pawn in the Capitals game. And I could see that from his little 2-minute clips. And I felt like we got an hour and 45 minutes of the Francis Lawrence, the director, trying to show us that Katniss was going through this, but inadvertently we really saw what it was like going through that, and that deterioration both mentally and physically through PETA in just 2-minute segments with much less time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let me ask you this quick question, because I'm not actually sure, even as a book reader, was PETA, when he's doing those propaganda videos, was he under duress? Was he just doing it to kind of play along and hope everything worked out? Or was he being brainwashed that whole time?
I thought the whole point was that, I mean, it's still from Katniss's perspective in Mockingjay. So we're not 100% sure why it's happening, but Katniss in her, in her inner monologue throughout the entire book, I'm pretty sure that she's putting the pieces together of why he's being, and I mean, I think they mentioned it in the movie, that she kind of comes to the realization that, PETA's just sort of like Snow's basically manipulating PETA to manipulate Katniss. And I think in the books, even, I think it kind of starts off that PETA does come across as like a traitor. And I think that that's a part of the inner monologue, is that, is he actually a traitor? Is he not? But by the end, it's pretty obvious that he has been being physically abused, psychologically tortured, and then, obviously eventually chemically altered as it says at the end of Mockingjay, that he's being chemically manipulated to harm Katniss.
Well, again, having not read the books, I could only go on what the film was trying to show me. And based on what it was showing me, I saw PETA basically doing the exact same thing that Katniss was trying to do. Survive in the world as she understood it, while also prioritizing the life of, the other person. So I would say that PETA probably was not highly coerced into the beginning, because from PETA's point of view, like the movie eventually shows, he thinks District 12 is still there. He assumes the Capitol is in complete control. And they probably say, someone's captured Katniss. We don't know why. If you go on TV, convince her to basically come back. And so he goes, this is what will save Katniss. This is what I'll do, considering the world that I knew before the second games. Because he thinks the world is still the exact same way. And he doesn't understand that things have changed. And as he starts to realize that things have changed, because things are getting bigger and grander in scale, and the Capitol's grip on what they can hold as truth slips, PETA starts realizing that maybe he's not getting the whole story, which is why they make a big point about, like, PETA has never seen 12. He doesn't realize that 12 isn't there. And they're trying to show PETA 12 so it'll stop PETA from doing these things. And once he stops becoming useful because they realize that he can't actually get Katniss to stop, then that's when they turn him into a weapon. That's when he becomes more emaciated and obviously physically harmed and things like that. And so I don't see him ever being malicious. I do see him being coerced, but there's a time when he's coerced and he's kind of understanding that that's what they want, and then at some point his mind changes, which I'm hoping is similar to what's going to happen to Katniss in the next film to a certain degree. It's something that I want to talk about. Like, well, almost everyone's talking about how this movie is about propaganda, the power of the media, things like that. And the thing that I like that it hinted at, but I wish it would have gone a step further, is that typically in propaganda, there's always two sides, and rarely is one of those sides actually right. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Because it's because I think even that, you know, PETA, and just to kind of wrap that up as we move into that, you know, PETA and Katniss were both, I mean, technically being manipulated, but manipulated in such a way that out of their love and care for one another, but they're just being manipulated by different sides. You know, PETA's trying to keep Katniss alive, and Katniss is trying to keep PETA alive, but they both have different aims at that point. And so, you know, the whole media propaganda thing is just, you know, getting in the way of them being able to take care of each other, I guess, so to speak, which was the major theme of Catching Fire.
Mm-hmm. You know, Fizz, I think I hear you saying, or you're kind of guessing at what might happen. So Josh and I both know what's going to happen next, but are you kind of, are you kind of hoping that the next movie tackles, is there a side that's right, or are they both wrong? Is that kind of what you're, where you're heading?
Well, the way that, well, I would say yes, to answer it simply, but to expand on it, I would say one of the things that I think works for the Hunger Games series is that it's a pretty honest critique of the media, like the meta picture that it's painting, mm-hmm. people's desire and willingness to oversaturate themselves and just be unconscionable media viewers. You know, like they'll watch as much as possible and they don't care what the content is. And I think the Hunger Games strikes a chord, a very accurate chord about society in that way. And I think if they're going to continue to strike that very accurate chord about what it's like to overconsume or to inundate oneself with media, then they have to kind of go to the place where one side of a propaganda machine is usually never the right side. Or, well, no, neither side is usually the right side. And in this one, to me, you know, obviously no one's on the Capitol side who's watching this movie. But I feel like, even though to a certain degree well-intentioned, I don't think that the district 13 or the rebels, or however you define them, are necessarily blameless. So I want them to show that. I want them to go in that direction. I mean, this is what we get with politics, right? This is, you know, whatever, if you don't identify with, you know, left or right, and you often find yourself in the middle, then you realize that when the left says something about the right, it's not really the whole truth, and vice versa. When the, you know, when the right says something about the left, you know, it's not necessarily the whole truth. But if you're in one of those camps, you're willing to wholly just make excuses. You know, they're like, oh, it's just telling the truth about the other guys. Mm-hmm. You know, when in fact you're being negative or whatnot. It's amazing how our identity in those situations, and right now, you know, I think we're all identifying with District 13, and so we're kind of giving District 13 a pass for using Katniss as a propaganda machine.
Yeah, it would be interesting to see. I know this won't happen, but
spoiler alert.
No. This is
no, I know.
No, I'm saying I know this won't happen from a production standpoint. It would be interesting to see what's happening from PETA's perspective. So maybe I don't know if they'll decide to go this way with the movie, but what if part two starts with just some, not maybe not montage, but clips of what PETA was experiencing, and then we're seeing him see the Katniss's propaganda for the first time, and it would be interesting to see sort of his slow, you know, not demise, but kind of downfall into where we're left at the end of part one, and maybe that's even a good way to catch viewers back up. But yeah, I think you made a great point there. We're siding with District 13 because that's where Katniss is. But does that mean that they're the right side?
Well, I think one of the things that the thing that propaganda does is that it basically reduces someone to one thing or one issue, or basically labels people. And in this particular case, like I said, the story's being told from the good guys' side. Like, I want President Coin to be bad to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm.
to kind of be honest with the metaphor that the Hunger Games is basically putting out there.
What did you think about Julianne Moore as President Coin?
I felt like most of the other characters in this movie, she was not given a whole lot to work with. Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping that the president was more interesting in the book. So
I honestly feel like the movie did a not very good job with her. I feel like that's the fault of somehow the screen adaptation or the direction that she was given, or I mean I don't even know if maybe it was what she took from the character when she was, you know, sort of acting it out. But it came off as not who President Coin really is in the books or in the story. I thought that was the big missing piece that probably actually would have satisfied what you were just talking about, Fizz.
How is she in the book? What's different?
What's different in the book is that Katniss doesn't trust her at all because she is sort of almost the same way as President Snow, kind of amorphous. She's very cold, very calculated. And, you know, there's just like there's a tension that I wish that would have been translated onto the screen between mm-hmm. Katniss and Coin that's just not in the movie, that's in the book. You know, Katniss never really trusts her. And, you know, it's just not there. And it could potentially be a detriment to the second part, but that's as far as I'll go, because that's sort of like that's going into territory where, you know, non-book readers don't want to go.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think that was the biggest thing, and I'm not sure whose fault that's going to end up being. If that's, you know, Francis Lawrence's direction, or if that was Julianne Moore's take on the character, or what? Because it's in the book, and I can't imagine that Suzanne Collins was like, "Now let's change the character for the movie."
So did you pick up on the same thing, Matt?
Yeah, I exactly what Josh is saying. With no spoilers, there was more tension between the relationship or in the relationship between Katniss and President Coin. And I think she was, this is in some ways, she was asking herself the question that you're asking, which I think is actually kind of awesome that you're almost picking up on something that I feel like the screenwriters weren't putting in there well, which is, can we trust this character who we don't know anything about? And mm-hmm. And just me playing with the character's name, is she the you know, the other side of the coin for President Snow, right? Like questions that Katniss was asking that I don't think moviegoers were like really allowed to ask in the same way. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool that you picked up on that.
Well, like I said, I mean, we'll have to see where it goes, and that's why I think a part two of this movie can make this first one so much better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like I said, I haven't read. I don't know where exactly it's going to go. I don't know if it's going to pay off. But to me, if they do something with President Coin, and we're like, do you remember that first part when she was all the good guy and then crazy stuff happens? That was calculated. I don't know exactly what they'd do with it. And I'm actually a little interested to see, because lots of people are pseudo assuming that they're going to change the ending a little bit, because you guys have both already said this. And most people, not everyone who I know has read the book, really didn't like either the way the book ended or just the third book in general. So I'm interested to see if they're starting to set us up for something different.
I was actually really prepared for a total script change, or, you know, like story plot point change.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have been fine with that. I hope they really mess with the whole ending of I'm not talking about just the very end. I'm talking about just like this part two. I'd be fine if they totally change it. I don't
just completely redid it.
Yeah, totally redo it. I don't care.
Interesting.
Well, okay, so since we're comparing the book and the movie a lot, do they deal with the feelings of loss, and just I almost feel like Katniss a lot of time is like a bipolar character, like she's lost, she doesn't know what she wants to do, and then all of a sudden something happens, she springs into action, and she puts aside her, like I said, what we're calling like the PTSD from the games, and she is the hero we all need, even if she's not the hero we wanted. So, like, are the books showing her in as much conflict or in as much turmoil trying to get over her time in the games?
I don't even think it's a get over. I feel that the book is definitely an exploration of what, you know, what's happening to her throughout the history of this. And I mean, basically, she's a manipulated symbol through all three of these movies, and or books, or four movies, excuse me. And there's definitely a tension that she has between wanting to do it and not doing it. And I think, you know, again, I'm going back to the whole coin character, but like that's some of that, you know, coming back through is that District 13. And I'm not sure if they play this up enough in the movie, that District 13 is a really cold, calculated society.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something that she doesn't like about it. And she basically, in the book, she comes off as like, you know, she comes off like a teenager at times. She's really, like you said, bipolar, you know, kind of moody and cranky and reluctant. And I think that really comes off in the book Mockingjay, that she's really struggling with pushing forward with being the Mockingjay to be able to rescue PETA, to be able to save the one she loves, and not wanting to continue to be this manipulated propaganda symbol. And I think that's a really strong tension. Like, I think even more so in the book, like, you know, she keeps ducking out of the structured times, because do they go into this and I just missed it, but I'm pretty sure in the movies they don't really talk about how District 13 is like very regimented. Like, they have set times for everything. They have set times for reflection and exact times for everyone to eat and all this other stuff, and she just bucks that because of what she's gone through. And I don't really think that they get into that in the movie, and I can understand why, but I thought it was a useful piece to sort of build that tension in the story of how she just doesn't want to be a part of what they're doing, but she's sort of reluctantly a part of this rebellion to a certain extent.
Yeah, just to add on to that point, I think you're right on, Josh, about District 13, just the setting and the atmosphere helping to just lead readers and hopefully moviegoers in a certain direction for how they may feel about what's actually happening. And it's interesting to look at the Capitol versus District 13 and how things are there. So Capitol, you've got people living in excess, and it's all about fun and entertainment. And then in District 13, it's, you know, dark and, like you said, very structured and to the point of almost a military state.
It's very Spartan. You know, that's kind of the word that I got from it. You know, everything is very martially oriented and Spartan. Like, you know, they don't have luxuries. Like Haymitch says, you know, they don't have alcohol there.
Yeah, and I was thinking of Prim wasn't allowed to have a cat. Like, just little things like that.
Right.
Really, so the stark difference between District 13 and then the, you know, colorful capital full of everything you'd ever want.
Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself is kind of what I reflected on, not necessarily what I think the movie focused on. There were a couple scenes, nothing that I recall, where they talked about how everything was regimented, but they did kind of allude to the fact that it was very minimalist, almost a militaristic kind of society. And we often see, you know, Plutarch having to kind of nudge President Coin to be like, well, that was efficient, you know, but not realizing that efficiency doesn't change hearts and minds often. So there was some of that in the background. But what it said to me was, again, neither side is the right way. Because you're not going to, like, if District 13 ever succeeds, like, no one's going to want to live like District 13. Like, people in District 13 are necessary to continue to live like people kind of want to live. And people in the capital are excessive and just don't need to live that way. And so it's like, which is it, excess or minimalist? And much like I think everything in life, you know, I as a Christian would say neither is the right answer. There's a third way that's way better. And that's one of my problems with some of the young adult dystopian movies that have been coming out recently. They always picture the right way as being the opposite of the most oppressive way. And that's usually not the right answer. Like they usually strike the answer to total, you know, to totalitarianism is ultimate free will. And I'm like, that's not the answer either. There's the better answer. And it's this beautiful meshing of, you know, serving and freedom. Mm-hmm. And like I said, in this one, I feel like that's why I want there to be tension, because I want someone to point out that District 13 is not the answer to the Capitol. It's just a foil to the Capitol.
Man, this is kind of frustrating that they had to split it into two movies.
Okay.
No, it is hard to... It is kind of strangely hard to talk about what could be when you actually know what one version of the story is. That's why I'm really hoping that they mess with it a little bit. That way
they change it up.
Yeah.
Well, so we had we actually put it out there. We're like, hey, does anyone have any questions or anything they want us to definitely hit? And we got a question, because I knew we were going to talk about this anyway. So I wanted to make sure I give them credit, that Jesse Rice on Facebook, he put, any thoughts on how or if the hanging tree reflects the themes present in the film?
That's a good question.
So Matt volunteered to sing the entire song for us, so we're just going to sit back and...
Go ahead, relax, everybody. You know, okay, so, you know, I'm in the movie, hearing her sing, you know, fine singer. It's not the best song ever, but I didn't exactly get how that became the kind of rallying cry for all the other districts. I guess maybe I didn't follow the lyrics very closely, but do you happen to have them there, Fizz?
Yeah, okay, so I have the lyrics, because I made sure once we got this question in from Jesse, so thanks Jesse for the question. I made sure I had all the lyrics so that we could not screw this up. And basically there's four stanzas and they're all the same except for one line that changes. And the stanza itself is, are you coming to the tree? Then there's a line that changes every stanza. And then it says, strange things did happen here. No stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. So that's repeated over and over. And the things that change is in the first stanza, they say, are you coming to the tree where they strung up a man they say murdered three? And the second stanza, it says, are you coming to the tree where the dead man called out for his love to flee? And the third stanza, it says, are you coming to the tree where I told you to run so we'd both be free? And then the fourth one, it ends with kind of what makes me ask the same question you do, Matt. It says, are you coming to the tree where a necklace of rope side by side with me? So it seems like the whole song is pointing to a like, as far as a rallying cry, it's like, come and die with me.
Yeah,
because we did something bad, you know. Yeah. So I want it to be like a rallying cry, like take up arms with me, but it seems like just accept the fact that you're gonna die.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. And then if you do look at the scene where they rushed into the hydroelectric plant, if you look at the front lines of that group of people, they were going there just to die. Like, the exact plan was, you people in front, you're gonna die, but we'll pick up the thing when you drop it.
Well, and so as far as a rallying cry for me, it falls short, because this song, again, to me, seems like, come and accept the punishment for this thing that has happened, or come and die and accept punishment along with me for something that I did. Whereas I feel like the movement or the song as a rallying cry should say something like, come and be willing to die because, you know, we want to be set free, you know, like things like that. Like it's worth dying for. This seems like it's selfish. Like, come and die with me because I don't want to be without you. Mm. So as far as a rallying cry, I think it is silly, but to Jesse's question, you know, how does it reflect a theme in the film? I think it's actually pretty good. And I think as far as a theme reflection, it's great, because I think what it does is it gives us a pretty good reflection of the people who have survived the games.
The victors?
Yeah, the victors, which are really still the losers. One of the articles we'll link in the show notes actually describes it as, like, there's losers and then there's less losers.
Oh, yeah.
Like no one who wins the games really wins. Like, mm-hmm. the question is posed, does anyone really survive the games? I mean, we see what happens to all the people who have actually made it out. And I thought Catching Fire did a great job with this, about how, like, just the anger and frustration of people who had to live through that, and then they're going to be told to live through it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so this song, when I think about the theme, this to me is basically, you know, Katniss could be singing this to PETA or vice versa.
Mm. And what I thought was really interesting was what I caught as kind of like a theme, if we're going back to the whole idea of propaganda and careful manipulation of media, is mm-hmm. that Plutarch changes that one word, wear a necklace of rope, to a necklace of hope, side mm-hmm. by side with me. And so, you know, they like kind of pat him on the back for that. And I thought that was an interesting tip to the fact that, you know, where Katniss is reflecting on the fact that, you know, we're all going to die. This isn't necessarily a rallying cry. It's more of a, you know, this expression of, like, there are no winners mm-hmm. in all of this. Plutarch has to slightly be like, we have to make sure that we are saying, like, we are going to win this rebellion, mm-hmm. you know? And so he changes that one lyric from rope to hope.
And so, hopefully no one knows the actual words.
Right, exactly. And hopefully they don't, because it had been a song. I don't think that they said this in the – did they say it in the movie that it had been a song that was actually banned by the Capitol? So it you know, no one could sing it. And if it was sung out loud, you could be punished.
I think it was just understood, because if you – it's like if you breathe too loudly, the Capitol would punish you for something.
So. Yeah. When we were talking earlier about the victors, they weren't really winners. But even anybody that didn't participate in the Hunger Games but still had to watch it and see their children go through that misery, they're also survivors of sorts. And now as they are attacking the Capitol's soldiers, and they're blowing up the hydro plant, in a sense, they're not in the Hunger Games, but they are in a game of sorts where they are trying to survive, but also know that a lot of them are going to die in the midst of it. So it's basically like the games now have left the arena, and it's in the real mm-hmm. everywhere.
Mm. Well, I also think it's pretty interesting, because this to me could also, like, you know, we like I talked about earlier, we can take a step back and make this one of those meta commentaries. This could be rather indicting of, again, the unconscionable media consumption that we have, because we'll all too often watch the news, and we watch someone or footage of someone doing something terrible on TV, and we're like, okay, they're the bad guy. You know, they're the one who needs to be taken down to the hanging tree mm. because they need to be punished for whatever crime they committed. But in reality, we're still a part of that. And so our place, even though we didn't kill anybody, by feeding that culture, like, we probably need to bring our necklace of rope and be right there next to them. Yeah. And you know, this is consistent with the, you know, like, there is none righteous, you know, like, we're all terrible people,
yeah,
at the root. And it's really easy for us to say, like, well, this person murdered, you know, a man, they say murdered three, for example, you know, and say he's a terrible person. But you know, that kind of takes us out of it. And so they're always calling us back to the truth, which is, you know, we need to be there at the hanging tree as well. Mm. One of the things that you take that meta commentary and point out is that, you know, Jennifer Lawrence herself is also going through like the oversaturation of media, you know,
yeah.
like her controversy of having nude photos leaked of her and people consuming these without thinking about who it affects or what it does.
For sure.
Yeah. And this is the same thing that we try to do through this podcast. You know, don't just watch this movie. Think about what you're consuming and why you're consuming it.
And just
at least that's the hope.
Just to be clear, Fizz, just to be clear, you're not going to link to those in the show notes.
Oh, I'm not going to link to those in the show notes.
Okay. Jeez. Just wanted to make sure.
Way to go, Matt.
Thank you.
Knocking the show down a couple notches.
Oh, wait. I said not. No, I'm just not link.
I mean, I wouldn't even know where to link him from, but I guess if you've got that link, if you're sharing it, I don't know.
This is getting weird, Fizz.
That is. It's getting kind of weird, isn't it?
Okay, so let me go to a link that we might want to share. Christian,
okay.
I think you shared with me this article from Christianity Today, and this mm-hmm. is where I was tying into Star Wars earlier. I think it was them that had some quick bullet points on how the Star Wars original trilogy franchise does resemble The Hunger Games. So okay. I'm going to read these quick bullet points, and you guys say agree or disagree. Ready?
Okay.
Both are about rebellions against a nondescript political tyranny.
Check.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
both are driven by love triangles that ground the epic stakes in human emotions.
Oh my gosh.
Not check.
I think I disagree with this one.
I don't know. I remember, Fizz, that I think, and this is calling back to the fact that I've listened to your interview with James Harleman like eight mm-hmm. times. I think he actually said, because he was able to experience the trilogy, and I think that he said before there was, the Twilight with, you know, the different teams. I don't even know the names of the people in Twilight because I can't even stand that series. But, like, he said there was, you know, Team Han and Team Luke before the Empire – or during The Empire Strikes Back.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know.
Before you find out that there's no team anymore.
Right, exactly. Before the horrible twist.
Well, maybe I'll answer this with a caveat. Like, I would say I would check it off because I think that's what the Hunger Games wants. Hmm. But I think of all the things that this series, at least through the film, from what I've seen, does well, the love triangle is the worst part.
Mm-hmm.
It is. It does not. What did you? How did you phrase it, Matt? Or how did the thing phrase it?
Yeah. It says it's grounded. That the love triangle would ground the epic, in human emotions. But I think it's true that they do try to ground it in human emotions. But I totally agree with you that the love triangle here and in Star Wars, not be driving the plot.
Yeah. Maybe grounded isn't the right word. It's not the right way to describe either of them.
All right, I'll read the next one here. Both boast better actors than we're used to seeing in these kinds of movies.
That's a toughie.
I think this one probably has better actors than the original trilogy.
Probably so.
Yeah. Like, are we saying the main leads?
Because
if that's the case, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could call Harrison Ford and Jennifer Lawrence are the two sort of more known actors at the time. And then, you know, Carrie Fisher and Mark Hamill were sort of obscure, and Josh Hutcherson and Liam Hemsworth were, you know, not that proven.
I guess it depends on where you go with it, because I think the core cast of Star Wars would be considered better than you'd think for that type, that genre, especially when it came out. But if you're talking about just the core cast for The Hunger Games, outside of Jennifer Lawrence, I'm not that impressed. But once you get past Hemsworth and Hutcherson, and you get into like Woody Harrelson and Donald Sutherland, Elizabeth Banks, things like that, then it starts to kind of uptick again.
Yeah, and I guess you can say Star Wars had two really good, well-known actors in it. You know, Alec Guinness and Peter Cushing, both extremely well-known, well-respected actors.
Let's not forget about James Earl Jones. Some fine voice acting.
Yes, that is true.
Speaking of James Earl Jones, next one. Both sparingly but effectively use villains who scare us because of just how much they terrify our heroes.
Mm. Okay.
True.
Yeah, true. And the last one.
Donald Sutherland's terrifying as President Snow.
He's actually, I think he's great in these movies.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Last one, kind of funny. Hard to disagree with. Well, maybe not hardly. thinly plotted serials. Both are thinly plotted serials that serve as an excuse for linking together battles, escapes, rescues, and romance. I hate to agree, but it might be fair.
It might be. I mean, they're...
I feel like that was the case until I saw... Well, actually, the first Hunger Games movie...
Fizz, I'm sorry to ruin part two of Mockingjay for you, but there are Ewoks.
Come on, man. I'm surprised.
Okay, so I actually just had this conversation yesterday with the biggest Star Wars fan that I know. And we were talking about what our favorite Star Wars film is. And I still contended that, like, I like Return of the Jedi the most. I would not say it's the best film, but I like it the most because for some reason, as dumb as, like, Ewoks are, they just don't bother me at all. Like, especially in the movie. Like, they work. I think they could have been done a lot more silly. They could have been Gungans.
Yeah,
for example.
No, I think they don't bother me either, but I think the reason is it has to be the time period you see them. So if you see Ewoks for the first time as a kid, then they're fine. Mm. But if you see Ewoks for the first time as an adult, then you hate them. So I saw Gungans for the first time in my teens, hated them. but a lot of kids love Jar Jar.
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty solid theory, but there wasn't a lot of Ewoks, like, flatulating on each other. and...
But it does have the impractical part where there's a big pile of Ewoks totally besting a bunch of highly trained stormtroopers.
Not quite as, I mean, like, survival woodsy type small bears who know the territory in the forest, have some strategic traps set, as opposed to Jar Jar, who gets a thing stuck on his foot and accidentally kills lots of droid bots because he's trying to get it off.
Oh, man.
That, to me, like, is the difference between, like, the acceptability of Ewoks, you know, to a lesser extent. Like I said, it's still semi-silly. I don't necessarily argue with that. But that's the only caveat to your theory, Matt, that I would have.
Okay, that's fair.
I submit that you appreciate Jar Jar much better if you watch the YouTube video of that whole scene sped up and to the theme of Yakety Sax.
Oh, yeah. Almost everything. Well, so now that we're now we're actually talking about Star Wars. I don't think the Hunger Games series, I wouldn't say thematically, but narratively, is that different from Star Wars. But then again, I think the comparison you can make between the two is one that you can make between almost any movie that has, like, the first one that you mentioned, like a rebellion fighting against a nondescript evil empire. So,
yeah, I mean, I guess I could see Joseph Campbell's hero's journey a little bit in Hunger Games, but it didn't guide the script the way it did Star Wars.
No.
Yeah. Oh, and that's the thing. This movie, I think, but maybe if they would have made it one movie, and again, I don't know how it ends, I would say this movie veers off course further from what I would have expected than, especially either the other two. The other two are almost, you know, right on point for what I would have expected in a start to a franchise, in the step up, both from an action standpoint and a going deeper standpoint in Catching Fire. This one should have been like almost the conclusion, but it really was a really long act one. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Well, we're probably getting about that time, so we'll start winding it down a little bit and try to avoid talking about Star Wars for another hour. By talking about the thing or things in this movie that made us scratch our head and or just say, come on. And Matt, like I said, we decided you were the Skypiest, so you get to go first.
Oh, thank you guys. Well, I have a few.
Okay.
But there's one huge one that stands out amongst all of them. So let me set the stage. There they are. District 13. Katniss just shot her first propaganda video, and they're showing it to the whole chamber where everybody's all gathered together. President Snow is up on the big platform. So they're watching on these video screens, and the end of the propaganda video is the end of every Hunger Games movie trailer. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Symbol and the fire flashes on the screen. Mm-hmm. Just do the little whistle. And I started laughing out loud at the theater because it's as if they just watched the trailer to their own movie all together.
Oh, I just want you doing the Hunger Games theme to be like the intro to this podcast.
Okay, I'll admit I can't whistle, otherwise I would have went there, so I had to do a little humming sound effect instead. So
it didn't detract from your point, it just added to it.
Thank
I
you.
Promise.
So that was my biggest come on moment.
Okay.
I also hated that primitive idiot in the sense that they're on lockdown, like they are about to die, probably. And she went back for a cat. First, yeah. Cats are the worst of all pets.
Because they can't whistle.
And secondly, who let her go back? Everybody is running downstairs. If anyone saw a little girl going the wrong way, wouldn't they say, hey, little girl, I think you're confused. We're going here because of the bombs. So that...
Or she would have been trampled to death like Katniss almost
exactly.
was.
Yeah, totally.
No kidding.
And so I know Katniss had to go back because she's a hero and it's her sister. But can you imagine how lame it would have been if after the first Hunger Games kicked off because Katniss volunteered to save her sister and then her sister dies saving a cat? That it would have been a little pointless there.
She just was following the example her big sister set. Yeah.
So that was my other one. And then my third one's not as strong, but Finnick, there was a lot of buzz around who are they going to cast as Finnick, this fan favorite from the books. And he had a pretty big role in the second movie, but Finnick was basically, I mean, he was really underused in this movie. Not that there was a lot, Josh, I can't really remember how much he was used in the book. So, help me out here if he was a big factor, but I just kind of felt like they could have maybe done more with him. His speech in the middle of the kind of military rescue, where they were kind of juxtaposed together. That was cool. I mean, it helped push the story along, but that was the only thing I really remember of him from the movie. I don't know. Josh, how much was Finnick used in this book?
Yeah, well, he wasn't used a lot, I think, in the first part. I mean, he kind of comes more to the forefront in the second part.
Wait, are you talking about when you say second part, you mean
of the book?
Fire, or do you mean...
Like, of the book. I mean, because the book is actually split up into parts, too. There's, like, part one, part two, and part three of Mockingjay.
Okay.
All the books are split that way, though.
Sure. But, I mean, he has that sort of part where he's definitely psychologically damaged just as much as Katniss is. And I think he's slightly physically injured. And is in that the hospital ward with her at the start, just like in the movie. But I'm pretty sure that he is more of like a, he really kind of jumps to the front when the action kicks off in the book. Like he's used sparingly in the first part of the book, if I remember correctly, maybe I'm not remembering right either. And we're both just, not remembering an important fan favorite.
Yeah. So those are my come on moments, Josh.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking kind of along the same lines with the cat. Like, there's no cat in the world that would want to go in a satchel and just stay in it like that. Like, that satchel was very, very calm with a big giant cat inside, first of all. So just piggybacking off of your point, I had that thought that there's no way that, especially a cat that's supposed to be jokingly in the books of that kind of temperament towards Katniss. Like, I mean, I know, I guess the cat makes it there in the book too as well, but you know, I just thought maybe the cat would put up more of a fight, because I don't know of any cat that enjoys being in a small dark space for a long period of time, you know, getting stuff thrown at it or whatever.
If it fits, it sits.
You know, you would expect that more from a dog. You know, dogs are willing to be inside. I don't know. I remember some old lady one time, a long time ago, when I worked in a store, she came in with a dog in her purse. So, you know, you expect that more from dogs, not from angry, temperamental cats. Man, do I have any, come on, you stole my thunder a little bit. I don't really have any good come on moments, and yours are really good, Matt. You know, I mean, I guess this is going to seem kind of lame as my come on moment, but my overall come on moment was from the character development standpoint of Coin. I thought the major thing was that she came off more like a mother than a president. And that was kind of like, by the end of the movie, I was just like, come on, what's the deal with this character?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, so I have a couple, I guess, meta ones. I just love using the word meta tonight for some reason. But then one specific scene that, like, actually made me, like, I raised my hands in the theater while I was basically saying, come on! So the big picture ones mostly revolve around the love triangle, or the lack of love triangle in this love triangle. Mm-hmm. Because at one point I was just like, I don't care if, you know, whatever Liam's character is, Gale, I don't care, because I feel like no emotional investment in Gale and Katniss as a couple. And I don't feel like Katniss being bipolar most of the time deserves PETA to like her at all. So this whole, like, trying to get us to care about this love triangle, I'm done with. I've been done with since the first movie.
Mm.
So there's that. And the one that actually made me throw my hands up, and maybe it's because I typically come from this, like, pro nonviolent position, is when Haymitch, like, takes over the propaganda machine and is, like, giving everyone the ABCs of how to make good propaganda. And he's like, what has Katniss done that everyone really liked? And they start naming all these things. And he goes, okay, what did they all have in common? And I'm like, oh, great. They're actually going to point this out, that none of them had anything to do with her fighting. Like, they're all, like, singing a song for somebody. Like, they're all self-sacrificial and merciful acts. Like, these are the things that people are resonating with.
Mm.
Not, like, her being combative or in this, like, leather suit with a super explosive arrows or anything. And no one picked up on that. And everyone was like, oh, it's because she was naturally killing people. I'm like, that's none of the things that you guys just listed that you loved about Katniss. So I was frustrated as a viewer and as someone who didn't really, I wasn't behind the propaganda, but I guess that was the point, right? So, but we end on a positive note. Matt.
Yes.
What did you like about this movie? Why, you know, what stuck with you?
Okay, so we talked about my top two things, so I won't harp on these too much more, but just, I mean, Jennifer Lawrence is acting amazing. Mm-hmm. Again, just like we said at the very beginning, the movie not just being completely from Katniss's point of view is such a benefit to the film, and mm-hmm. just being able to see things that we were maybe alluded to in the book, but we never actually got to see. So I love that. But some new things here. I really liked the scene where she went to the hospital, and kind of slowly walked up on the people, and they were, you know, noticing her one by one. And I don't know, I liked the reaction of the crowd, where it was almost as if she was going to be their savior. I just thought that played well. So like that one, I was sad with what happened afterwards, but I guess, like you said, that was the point.
Yeah.
And then kind of piggybacking off of what you just said, Viz, you didn't like the scene where they were trying to come up with what Katniss had done to evoke emotion in the past. But one thing I did like about that is it further helped develop Effie, where she was really the one that was speaking up with the ideas. It was as if no one else there really knew her except for Effie, which is kind of surprising considering how their relationship started.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of stuff about that that I liked, because I love them getting Effie back involved, and I love them getting Haymitch more involved.
Yeah,
I just didn't like necessarily their conclusions after they went, anyway, like I said, obviously after they went through all that stuff. So, but I love giving them more to do, because I thought they were great in Catching Fire.
And then
I could use more of them.
Lastly, just like a thematic standpoint, I thought it was interesting how they, the screenplay and the writers and the director, they dove into the idea of the business of war, and how it's not just the battle, but everything that goes on behind the scenes to actually
the marketing team.
Yeah, for sure. Job. So just that kind of just the idea of all the shenanigans behind the scenes. So cool.
Josh?
Yeah, so I've got one that's more visceral and one that's a little bit more thoughtful. So the visceral one is, I really thought that action beat where the district with all the lumberjacks, where they climb up into the trees and then blow up all the soldiers, it was just a really cool scene. Like, I thought it was kind of neat. And just, you know, how they all just shimmied up. It's like, huh, what would lumberjacks do to cause chaos? And they nailed it perfectly. You climb up into a tree, then blow everyone up that's on the ground. So I thought that was kind of neat. And the other thing that I really liked from a more thoughtful perspective is the scene where Gale and Katniss get to go out hunting, you know, in this real calm, serene forest. And, you know, they get those moments together. And I know that you're probably blanching a little bit at the idea of, like, I'm talking about the love triangle aspect. But I thought what was really neat is how nuanced they approached it. They didn't make it into a big, sappy romance scene. You know, it was just she put her head on his shoulder and that was it.
Yeah.
And then it kicks off like, oh, we got to go back. You know, but I thought it was really neat to sort of establish it differently than just being like, can we talk for a minute? You know, and then, you know, jump into like something that'd be straight out of Twilight and would try to like tug at a bunch of, you know, young girls' hearts and all that other stuff. And I just thought that was really neatly treated as compared to how movies would normally do it, I guess, for that genre. And just make it all kind of sappy and lame. And it was really just a little bit more tactfully handled and more nuanced than it could have been. And so I appreciated that.
Well, and I want to point this out too, because I think it's really great that I will almost never poo-poo on someone's like favorite parts of a movie. Because that's the beauty of a movie to me, that we can all take something different from it. Because depending on where we are and what we've been doing and kind of what's on our mind when we go to see these movies, like different things are going to resonate with different people, which is like I was saying before, I try to stay away from like, this movie is good or bad. And I kind of try to stick to like, this movie saying something, what is it saying to you? And I preface that because even though I've been fairly down on Josh Hutcherson, and I know lots of people in general, he's not really their favorite part of the Hunger Games, in this particular movie, and I mentioned it earlier in the show, probably my favorite thing about this movie, kind of like Effie was probably my favorite thing about Catching Fire, they're the character that I understand the journey of the narrative through. Effie in Catching Fire, slowly realizing what's going on and how Katniss is being used, and her going from just a uninvolved, detached capitalite to someone who is growing to love Katniss and sees the injustices that she's having to be a part of, that journey was something that I could follow through her. And in this one, Peeta is that person starting from like an optimistic things can still be okay to, I don't think they're going to be okay to they're worse than I thought they were to, is there really any hope at all? Mm. And I followed that journey through Peeta and his very brief moments on the screen. So whether that was, like I said, writing or Josh Hutcherson bringing something to the role that I didn't really see him bringing in the previous movies, kudos. Because like I said, that's how I was able to stay interested, even though I think that at times the film kind of got a little long-winded and maybe even lethargic. So... Mm-hmm. That's probably the thing that I enjoyed the most. Like I said, I wish there was a lot more. We got little snippets from like Effie in this one, from Haymitch, Plutarch, like little snippets. And I was like, oh, I wanted more of that, and I wanted them to be my favorite parts, but they didn't quite hit it. We finally wrap up by saying, you know, what's your recommendation to people about this movie? Any final thought that we didn't hit on? Anything that you want to leave listeners with about this movie? So Matt, what's your final thoughts?
Yeah, so I would say this is a good movie. I did like it. Mm-hmm. I liked it more than the book. We've talked already about how there are some themes about, you know, of propaganda, and that's such a big part of this movie. The interesting thing though is, as some people have said, since I split the last book up into two parts, and some people feel like this is almost a filler movie. I wouldn't necessarily 100% agree with that, but I can see, like, even when Fizz, at the beginning of this episode, you read the general description, and I think you even described it as just a general, quick by the books description. But it hit every single story beat. It didn't miss anything. Like, you could read that was a complete synopsis of this movie. So. Yeah. In that sense, it was a little bit of a filler. So all that to say this, this movie is almost meta propaganda to set up just bringing you to part two. This whole movie really is pushing you to want to see Mockingjay part two, and just like draw people into that. So yes, it's about propaganda in the movie, but it also is almost a device of propaganda in the real world.
Cool. Josh, final thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I was kind of down on this movie in my review a little bit, and I don't know if it might have been a little bit unfair. It's a little unfair to make the comparison between the book and the movie, because the movie's got to be able to stand on its own. But I liked this movie, even though initially I think that I didn't like it when I walked out of the theater. But I like the movie. I like what it has to say. And I think it's good for what it was supposed to do, like Matt said, to set up the second movie. I think it'll leave people excited to see the last chapter. The last chapter will, I want to say, maybe we'll make more money than this one. but, you know, I think that this movie does have, and I think The Hunger Games is a series, once it is four complete movies, has a lot of extremely relevant conversations to start about media, truth, what we believe, who we take our truth from, and how we form our opinions on things. I think it has a lot of really interesting things to say about that, and I think it says a lot of things that are extremely relevant to our current culture. I mean, we could talk a lot more about that, but we've already had a lot more to talk about, and this is the recommendation portion. So I would say that, like, this movie is a lot more thoughtful than it can seem on the surface. It's not just a serial movie, and I liked it, and it's definitely – I'm definitely still excited to go see the last chapter.
Well, I would say that if I had to pick out only one phrase to describe this movie, I would say it's – thematically weighty. There's lots going on. Both you guys have pointed that out. And even though it was a little slow for me, and I felt like it at times did feel like a placeholder for the last one. I do reserve my judgment on how much I enjoyed it to until I see the next part of it and can kind of put those together as one long story. But as far as a recommendation goes, I'm assuming that if you're watching Mockingjay Part 1, you've either read the books or you've already watched the previous two Hunger Games movies. And there's enough to like about this series as a whole where if you, like I said, if you liked the Hunger Games and especially if you like Catching Fire, then you should be seeing this movie. I assume you already have if you're listening to this. And like Josh said, you're probably excited about seeing the next one as well. So you continue that trend. Just don't go and just eat popcorn and turn your brain off, because it does have a lot to say about our society right now, and it can spark a lot of great conversations. So with that, we wrap up, and I am so grateful for you guys spending time with me this evening talking about this movie. It's been a lot of fun. I assume that lots of people will want to continue this conversation with you guys. Mm-hmm. So, Matt, how can people find out what you do on the interwebs and how to get a hold of you and stalk you incessantly?
Perfect. Yeah. So I've got two podcasts you can check out, both coming from different directions. First one, The Sci-Fi Christian. It's my podcast where we talk about theology and science fiction. Well, not just that, but pop culture, speculative fiction, all that stuff. So that's the first one I do. And the second one is The Comic Book Time Machine. And you can find that at comicbooktimemachine.com. That's a newer one I've been doing with a couple of my friends, Ben Avery and Daniel Butcher. And on that, we discuss recent comic books, but also sometimes we'll go back into the past and check out some old ones and do reviews and just have some fun conversations there. So, yeah, those are the two ones, thescifichristian.com and comicbooktimemachine.com.
Nice. Josh, where can people find what you do?
Yeah, if people want to continue this conversation on Mockingjay, go to Real World Theology, where it seems like a lot of our listeners have really disagreed with all of my opinions on this movie. So I'm definitely excited, and I appreciate everyone who's commented and said stuff about the movie. But you can find me at realworldtheology.com. It's this great website that has movie reviews and a podcast. I'm getting very meta right now. You can find me there. I write 4 times a week, just, you know, kind of more fun thematic articles based on movies. And I'm getting more into reviews. I actually can safely say that I put out, you know, the Mockingjay review the other day, and I will have another one next week on the lesser known film Starred Up, which is a British film. I'm excited about that.
Haven't seen that yet.
Yes, it's going to be great. So you can find me there. You can find me on the Facebook for Movie Lovers, Letterboxd. it's fantastic. I love having conversations. Fizz took a dump all over my review of Under the Skin. So thank you for that.
Just keeping us honest.
Yeah.
Actually, film sharpening film, or critic sharpening critic. That's
exactly. Exactly. Precisely.
Push back.
So you can find me there. And lastly, I think I'll mention again, since you can follow Matt Anderson, you can follow Matt's route to getting to me and go on Facebook, and you can friend me on Facebook as well.
Thanks again for accepting my friendship.
Oh, yes. Yes. You're welcome.
I offer you my friendship.
I receive and reciprocate my friendship.
No, it's like one of my favorite scenes from Wayne's World, where he's like, I love you, man. And he's like, I love you, man. And he keeps saying it. Is everybody familiar with the scene?
Yes.
And eventually he comes up to Garth and he's like, I love you, man. He's like, thank you. that's the proper response. So, oh yeah. So where you can get a hold of me, if for some reason you're not tired of me talking, then you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter, or you can follow this show at Real World Theo. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then visit our website, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com, where we are getting more and more written content for you guys to peruse. You also get show notes and other great things. connect with us on Facebook. We're always posting things of interest when it comes to film theology. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. If you enjoy it, please review the show. We love your 5-star ratings. We've got a lot more of those recently. We really appreciated those. Some of the feedback we've been getting has been great. Mm-hmm. So keep interacting with us, tell your friends, and let's get more people involved in these conversations. So we're not just watching movies. We're kind of, having these great, just interactions with each other, really thinking about what we're consuming and why. So again, I just want to thank my guests for being here. So thanks, Matt.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Josh.
Hey, you're welcome.
I want to thank you, the listeners, for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye. This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.